want to spend the first part of today getting into what Original Blessings is about, at least my perception of what it's about. I just wrote a review of it in a packet that came out for the Resource Center, so you may have, if you've seen that, you'll catch some of my grasp of the book. But I wanted to back up and ask you to say some things here, and then get into small groups and discuss a couple of questions I have, and then come back as a group and sort of move into the contents of the Original Blessing. You all know what a continuum is. You know, a line from here to here. If this is a 1, and this is a 10, and that was a continuum about. My always example is how you feel about seatbelts. If you really were sold on seatbelts, you'd say I'm on that continuum at 10 because I know how many people have been saved by seatbelts. I put my seatbelt on before I get in the car, and I really love seatbelts. And if you were a 1, you know, some people were injured because they had their seatbelt on, and I'm worried about that. Or if you hadn't made up your mind on a seatbelt, you might be at a 5. No, so continue. I wonder if you would answer, without asking too many questions, give me your answer to where you are on a continuum of 1 to 10, where you were on a continuum of 1 to 10, when you were about somewhere between 6 to 10 years old. What is your recollection about whether or not you were religious? That would be a 10, very religious, or a 1, which was, you know, not very religious at all. I'm not asking you to say what did other people think about you, or I'm not even asking you what was it really like. I'm just saying, what do you remember now? Between ages roughly 6 and 10, did you see yourself as very religious, a 10, not very religious at all, a 1, or somewhere in between? Would you just make I'm going to ask you a number of questions in a row. Just write down number 1, 6 to 10, and then pick out a number, age 6 to 10, and then pick out a number and put it next to it.
I'm having more trouble with the word
that's
religious.
It's exactly the point of the session. Is for you to have trouble with the word religious. Okay? And we're going to come to that. All I'm asking is that we would wait.
Yeah,
that's all.
Yeah,
sure.
I see.
Sure. Absolutely. Good question. Second, number 2 down there. Again, what's your memory like? What do you recall about whether and how were you very religious or not or somewhere in between? Ages 13 to 18. Between age 13 and 18. What's your recollection? How many of you are between the ages of 20 and 25 now? Some of you are at least. Huh? Okay, the next question is that age. If that's now, then you're answering for now. Because then the question after this will be about now. Okay. So number 3 is between age 20 and 25, if you are above that now, put down what do you recall of whether you were very religious or not so religious during that period of time. Pick a number again. Put yourself on the continuum. And as I said, for some of you, that'll be right now. And then what you're saying is, well, how do you see yourself now? And the last one, the fourth one, is for all the rest of you. Put down number 4 and put down behind it, now, how do you see yourself? Do you see yourself as very religious, a 10? Or a 1, not very religious, or somewhere in between. That's the first thing that I wanted you to do, and I'm going to ask you to do a second thing, and then I'm going to invite you to go into groups. I'd like you to answer this question. There's a question that will go up here, but I'm going to ask you to pick out one of these answers and stick with it, and pretend that it is for the 10 seconds. The answer is for the 10 seconds in which you make that decision. In other words, 10 seconds before you could have another answer, 10 seconds later you could have a third answer if you want to, but pick one that was true for the 10 seconds in which you proved it. You know, in other words, you're gonna want to say maybe all of them, or seven of them, or two of them. I'm going to ask you to pick one, even though it might be true only for 10 seconds. Right? Okay? Where do you see the most evident signs of God's presence in the world today? Someone might choose in the Bible, in Jesus Christ, in nature, in other people, within myself, in corporate worship, in world events, in private prayer, in the gospel, in social movements, or pick another one and write it in, and just pick one of them that might be true for you for the moment.
Just one.
Pardon?
Just one.
Just one, as I'm asking you to take. Just for the moment. All right. Now I'd like to ask you in a moment to get in the groups, and here's the assignment for the groups, is to share your answers. First of all, by telling each one of you, I'm going to invite you to be in groups of three, tell about your spiritual development, your religious development, if you will. And in that process, share what that word religious means to you. How are you using it? And it might be used differently by each of you in the group, you know, whatever that is. Don't get lost on defining it. I mean, don't spend then the first half hour defining religious. But to say, the way I understand the word, it means blah, and then, so at age 6 or 10 or something, I was here. If there were changes, that's fine. You know, share that. You know, if you were up and down, or I've been a 10 forever in my life, and whatever you want to share. Share with one another about your religious development. Would you particularly answer the question, what was the nature of the development? You know, not just, I've always been a 10, but what does it mean to you to be a 10? Or if you change from that, why did you change, if you remember? You know? So what's the content and the nature of your religious development, too? If you'd be willing to do that. Under that also, if you would share, who are you aware of that's been most influential in your religious development? And the last part of that discussion, what's your, quote, religious, unquote, question or questions today? What is your religious question today? Again, and I'm asking you to use your definition of religion at that point. We'll talk about it after a while, and we'll get some common ground. But for this exercise, I'm asking you to use your own, just so you tell the other people what you're using. All right?
Say that again.
What's your religious question or questions today, using your own definition of religion or religious? It might be better just to share your answer to this one first, and then go into discussion about your development. Okay? And then we'll ask you to come back and share, not a report on what you said or all that stuff, but your reactions to that discussion. Okay? I hadn't planned any way to divide you up. Do you want to do that yourself, or do you want to just take where you're sitting? Do you have any preference about how to divide up?
This one I'm sitting.
Okay. Would you get into it? It'll be, if Dan doesn't want to sit in, that's up to him. It'll be three groups, three, and there'll be a four. Two groups of three and a group of four. Okay? And take, I'd say 15 minutes to share. You probably move in different parts of the room so you can talk without interrupting. Okay? Great. Okay, that'll be fine. I invite you to share your reactions to the discussion that you've been having. Anyone?
I don't want to stop.
Well, we'll get back at some of those things to be sure. Okay. I take that as a good sign. Rest of you?
was very aware that this is something I at least haven't experienced doing with others. Just dealing with that question that we're talking about. I don't know if that's because I haven't initiated it or if we just don't do that. Do the rest of you find that you often enter into conversation like that?
Except with close.
Pardon?
Friends. Really cool.
Can we just take a tally of everybody? Okay. It was kind of diverse in our group, and so I'm wondering if it was.
In response to this?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, let's just run down the line. How many of you, are you willing to share? I assume, and everybody's free not to. I hope you know that. That's a given at Holden, and so none of you are under big obligation. But if you want to share, how many of you had number one for your... Okay. How many number two?
Are we doing 6 through 10 now?
This one up here.
Okay.
Oh, excuse me.
I'm sorry. I went the wrong way.
How many had number three? How many number four? Okay. How many number five? Okay. How many number six? In court words. Okay. Number seven. How many number eight? How many number nine? How many number ten? And how about somebody number 11 had their own? Okay. That was diverse, you're right. Okay. That'll come from the same place. Would you have had one? Would you be willing to choose one, Dan?
You would just pick one.
Yeah, it? Just asking you for the moment, for 10 seconds to pick one.
Probably four.
Okay. And mine would be seven. Anything else to share out of what you said? Did you learn anything about yourself? You don't have to tell it all. I don't want to get that discussion going in, but...
One of the commonalities the three of us had was that none of us liked the word...
Religious
anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it no longer has the same meaning it once had for us, and so we don't know what we mean by it when we say whether we feel religious or not, because... Uh-huh. Sometimes it has a negative connotation now. Okay. We're not sure what we're responding to.
Would the word spiritual have made any difference to you?
Would have been better.
We all had trouble with the word.
Sure. Did you get a... Well, I assume you each used whatever definition or whatever other word you wanted. I would hope that you did. I was trying to avoid words that would skew. I mean, there's a number of words that would do it, and each one of them would have a different, kind of a connotation. And I really, as I said, I wanted you to struggle with the word too.
I think religious is that sort of word that you're sort of in discussion. We kind of on guard, and sometimes I feel on guard with the word Christian, because there seems to be a diverse. Meaning of what people say, I'm a Christian.
Yeah.
Or there is my concept of Christian, or to be a Christian is, as I tied with, as Christ lived, is somebody else may use the word Christian, and it's not at all the same way. In religious discussions, you're leery about some definitions without sort of spending days on laying groundwork on definitional words.
Yeah. Anyone else? Yeah, it seems almost any word related to that, whatever it might call. For instance, you could talk about the inner life, or the word spiritual for some people means things dealing with ethereal soul, the spirit, and doesn't have very much to do with life or mana or whatever else. And so there's the disadvantage there. And as you said, Christian, for some people, is born again, meaning that something else. Or the inner life sounds like it ain't got no connection with outer life. And so, you know, there are some difficulties for that.
And sometimes Christian doesn't include Christ, and I often wonder about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
I don't know if this is jumping ahead.
Go ahead.
A bit, but in just reading all I read, it's the introduction is really mm-hmm. a blessing. And the word mystic has, for me, always been kind of a almost non-Christian kind of a concept, I guess. But to be a mystic is not mm-hmm. really to be a Christian, but it's put kind of a new slant on the word being a mystic.
Sure.
And a new understanding kind of what, and so now, well, just what is the definition of mystic, and what has it been, and what is it today,
yeah.
and what is his meaning?
What his meaning, sure. Okay. Anyone else?
I found it interesting that for the women in our group, it was the women in our family who were most influential.
Oh, that's interesting.
And for David here, it was a male teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Just to point out, for me, it was my father.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
And over here, we were opposite Sandy. It was a male teacher, too. And for me, it was a pastor.
Male pastor.
And yours was male pastor also?
Mm-hmm.
You certainly have had more of those to choose
yeah.
from
yeah.
than
it's
women.
It's the male pastor, or it's the female of the household, or the female head of the household.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
Would you have somebody there, Dan, who has influenced you?
I think on a personal level, my mother did.
Mm-hmm.
More than my father. Although my father was a pastor.
Yeah. I don't think either. It wouldn't be my parents at all. It would be a male prof at somebody. Rich Kimmerer's father. Rich Kimmerer Sr. would be my.
There's a, I try to somewhat make a distinction, but in terms of most influential, I think, whenever you think of
yeah.
who has sort of affected your life, but in terms of religious concepts and understanding, Richard Hansen did that for me. Mm-hmm. But in terms of lifestyle, or terms of how one gives of oneself,
mm-hmm.
And perhaps, you know, subconsciously, perhaps more of an influence to me, I mentioned my mother. But
never be my mother for that for me. I learned how to be selfish for my mom. And I never had, I get this out on the table, I never had until, I did not have, until the early 70s, a formal situation in which I was taught in class by a woman. All of my teachers, from first grade on, were men.
Was
all of my teachers
school?
In high school, yes.
Oh.
Parochial school and parochial high school, prep school, and seminary.
All
for
them.
All of those years, I was taught by men. And then until I got to the university where I was Pam's pastor and purposefully sought out women to be taught by because they had, I was so much to. So you can see the narrowness and the poverty of my experience. Mm. And one of
uniqueness. I wonder how many people have had that experience.
Oh, in Missouri Synod, there would be a lot of my age.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're
a
Missouri Synod.
Pardon?
Are you a Missouri Synod now?
I was. No. I've been for a number of years. But that was my background. Okay. Well, I think what our friend Matthew Fox is getting at is, what does it mean? How do you understand what it means to be human? And in the context of a spirituality.
Say that over again.
I think he's asking, what does it mean to be human? To be a human being in a context in which you are aware of a God dimension. maybe another way to do it, and this is unfair because it seems rational, but because I don't think he is by any means trying to only be rational, how does it make sense to be connected to God in this contemporary world? And what you saw, if you read any of it or the introduction, he was saying that there's there is a basic paradigm, a basic model, a basic framework that is used in talking about the God-human relationship, and that's the fall redemption paradigm, or the fall redemption spirituality. And that is similar to what Dan was talking about, of course, consistently, but also again today, and that is that I wrote out some things here. Yeah, that it's a... there is sin and there is forgiveness. There is fall and there is redemption. There is earth and there is heaven. That those things just go into a line. Now, that's not all that the fall redemption paradigm does. And when he is careful... Matthew Fox says that, but he isn't often careful in this book. And as I've said in the review, and I'll say a number of times here, he is given to gross, well, you can't say gross, he's given to hyperbole. Hyperbole is the word that says when you say much more than is really true in order to be heard.
He always
talked that way, which would be hyperbolic. Because he doesn't always talk that way. But in order to make my point, if I said that, I would be using hyperbole. And he does that every once in a while. To make his point, he says, well, every evil that has ever been, ever, all in the world, all came from an overemphasis on fall redemption paradigm. Well, that's baloney, to be kind about it. That's just not true. But he does say that. And as I said, though, if you carefully read, go back, and as I've done, search for the places where he is trying to do it carefully, then he says that's really because it's been the only paradigm, or because there's been an overemphasis on it, or because it's been distorted, so that the background for that paradigm is original sin. And the opposite for him, then, is to get back to original blessing. Yeah?
He uses the word paradigm a lot. Yeah. I didn't know what it meant then, but can you expound his paradigm?
Well, paradigm would be the framework on which you hang your thinking, your process, the pattern against which you are judging or you're seeking understanding. A paradigm, I suppose, if there is one, or there surely is, for Holden Village would be the paradigm of mutual respect and an effort to do it. It doesn't mean, again, you achieve it all the time. The mutual respect and openness to differing points of view, that would be sort of the paradigm behind. If you want to understand, if you didn't have that, you wouldn't understand Holden very well, or you might be confused by it. But if you understand that what we are about here is in the light of the gospel of Jesus Christ and in an effort to live out some of what we see from Jesus Christ, that openness and acceptance is important to us. And that would be part, it would be all of it, it would be part of the paradigm. Another part of the paradigm would be sharing and work, that we live together in community and share and work would be part of the framework that's behind. It may not be obvious at a moment, now we are doing this, now watch us be open and accepting, but it's behind whatever you say.
The paradigm behind the landing is the Totoa concept.
The Totoa concept is the paradigm for the landing, that's correct. And the paradigm, theologically, that the church has since Augustine, as he points out, St. Augustine worked with largely has been the fall of humanity into sin and the redemption from that sin in Jesus Christ. And, that is a very valid paradigm. But if you go bananas on it, or crassly put, that's what Fox is saying. We've gone bananas on this paradigm. So that's the only way that people can think about it. And what it has been even narrowed down to more than that is that fall redemption simply means, for some people, certain sins. Or sins rather than sin. So rather that I have hated somebody, or I've even killed somebody, or I have neglected somebody, or whatever, or I haven't read my Bible, that those sins, rather than sin, which alienates me from God, the distancing me from any influence of God, or wanting to listen to God, the narrowness is that certain sins load guilt on me, and I'm hanging around with all that guilt until Jesus takes it away, and then I'm okay again, and I want to be sure that I'm okay again at the time I die, because then I will surely go to heaven, rather than what that alienation, being broken from God, the brokenness of my life, does to me now, and to the society in which I live, and to any sense of pleasure or joy that is meant by, I believe, the Creator for our life. So it has even been narrowed from what it might mean in one of its best senses, the fall redemption paradigm. It's legitimate. It's a basic one. It is a Lutheran one. It is one that the Lutheran Church uses. If you want to check it out, this is our book of basic teaching for the Lutheran Church, the Book of Concord. It goes back to largely the 16th century. I Xeroxed the page out for you, so you ought to know that original sin is certainly a teaching of the Lutheran Church. Want to fight with that sometime, somehow, somewhere? I don't know if there were enough comments.
Okay.
There's long sections in the... are there more? This is from the Augsburg Confession, which is sort of the confession of the Lutheran Church. It's the key one. Back in the time of Luther's Reformation, this was the sort of the best summary. And you see here, there is a page 29. There's two versions. One's the German version, that's on top. That's a translation from the German. And the Latin version down below, that's a translation from the Latin. But they're both the same. It's just to show some distinction there. That's since the fall of Adam, all people, see where they still wrote, who are propagated according to nature are born in sin. The only person not propagated according to nature, of course, is Jesus Christ, right? We're not aware of anybody else. Yeah, but this is their protection for not getting Jesus into sin. That is to say, they are without fear of God, they are without trust in God, and are concupiscent, which means that they are not only capable of doing something wrong, but they are inclined to. Concupiscence is being guilty for participating in what is wrong. And this disease or vice of origin is truly sin, which even now damns and brings eternal death on those who are not born again through baptism in the Holy Spirit. Now that was not new. That isn't distinctively Lutheran. That's the same as the Roman Church was saying at that day. And they were trying to say, this is what we teach the same way. What we're against is those people, Pelagians and others, meaning some people in the Roman Catholic Church who were saying that the vice of origin is, who deny that the vice of origin is sin, and who obscure the glory of Christ's merit and benefits by contending that a human being can be justified before God through his own strength and reason. So if you aren't really in such bad shape through your sense, your origin, then you might work it out some way. You might pay it off some way. You might somehow earn your way back into God's good graces. But the Lutheran teaching here, in consistency with our own church, is that you're in bad shape from the outset, and it's going to take action outside of you in order to overcome. Now I'm going to say some more about what I think is a fair understanding of my own and others' understanding of original sin that might not be as drastic as this. Luther taught it. What some people would call his deplorable extravagance of language. Martin Luther just went bananas in describing how great it was when humanity, before humanity had sinned, as if there were a time in which there were creatures, human beings, who had not been tainted by sin, and how perfectly they lived, and everything was just marvelous. This is a takeoff out of the story, what we would call, in its best sense, a myth, in Genesis and the origins of creation, and how sin came into the world in the fall stories. There's a number of them. There's two of them in Genesis, and a number of them in the Psalms, and a couple of them elsewhere in the Scriptures. That all of these are an effort to portray there was some perfect time, and then zappo, something happened, and then there's a bad time. And that's the time when we are bugged or bothered by sin, evil. Luther went bananas in describing this good time, which is total fantasy. He had no information, no knowledge, there is no record, there is no whatever, you know, for this. But he would describe how marvelous all this was, and then zingo, down here, whoa, the terrible stuff, to using the words like total depravity or total corruption, and of course, along with it, total guilt, so that people were concerned, absolutely nothing. To one point where there's a quotation Aristotle and his best of his thinking was rubbish. Rubbish. And that anything else that was done marvelously in the world is still all trash. That there is nothing possibly good at all. It's that deplorable extravagance of language, I think, that has put the original, and I'm talking about original sin a bit today, because then it seems to me we're going to have a context for talking better about original blessing. That's where our focus will be on the other, but I thought this introduction made more sense. That there is a problem in that to be human includes the possibility of things going wrong. That there is, for instance, in my teaching at university, I did not use the word sin, just because people had all kinds of barriers to it. They thought it was back to the old stuff, you're going to clobber them on the head, and if they give up drinking and extramarital sex and other kind of thing, then everything would be okay. All the things they liked, they were supposed to give up. But what I used, for instance, deception. Have you ever been deceived by anyone? And of course they all had. Had they ever deceived themselves? And of course they all had. And so self-deception and deception became my words that were used for getting at what is behind what sin is. And that sin comes from someplace. The question of thought for spiritual people aware of a God connection, has been, where did that problem come from? And the creation stories, the fall stories, if you will, in the Bible, were an effort to answer that. There was a time when it wasn't, and then this fruit was there, and then somebody ate, and that got into all people were touched by it. But if we understand those stories to be an effort to make some sense out of why there is deception and self-deception around, or because of that deception, self-deception, distance from God, or the possibility of people taking advantage of others, repressing others, destroying others, or wanting everything for themselves, certainly, or fear, why there is fear, any of those things. This was the effort of the church to make, give an answer to that. When it is more properly understood, it seems to me that what it is talking about is that sin, that negative dimension of life, isn't so much that everything is wrong so that the stream of life is solid mud rather than crystal clear water, but that sin has influenced everything, and that the possibility of anything and everything being negative is there. It's trying to acknowledge that part of a reality, that that's what original sin, I understand, to be about. That even the very best, if you will, human virtues are also tainted. And that the struggle is to, on one hand, make sense of that, on another hand, to be freed from that. And so, original sin obviously implies, just because of the word sin, holiness. There's no sin unless there is something anti to it. Just as to be a godless person assumes God. There must be something else. And so, in its rightful place, original sin is a call. The word, the phrase, and what lies behind it is a call to original blessing or to godliness, just by virtue of the fact that it implies there's something missing, and that something missing is really possible. Simply said, Matthew Fox believes that if, in addition to keeping the fall redemption paradigm, we add to it a creation-centered paradigm, we will be less, excuse the expression, screwed up about the relationship to God. Because he said what we have ignored is the good that God has given in all of his creation. That means in human beings, their possibilities for thinking and being and doing, and in the whole of the world around us, in nature. You as a class being here, and probably even because you've been together for a long time, we're not like most of the lay people who answered this question up here. Can you guess what more than 50% of the lay people answer? What number? Think for a moment, see if you could guess.
Five.
One.
Six. Hmm?
Three.
Three. Mm-hmm. Not clergy. No.
What a clergy say?
But the lay. Clergy runs between gospel and Jesus Christ and worship, but mostly gospel and Jesus Christ. Some Bible, but mostly. But the lay people, more than 50% of the people that I've done that with, and I've been doing that for here at Holden and elsewhere around the country, and it's just consistent. Mm. It's nature. You know, and then people, you know, right away you can be critical and say, well, you know, they want to go out and worship a tree or something like that. And I don't believe that. I don't say that. I think that it's most obvious. It's around. But it's when we get, quote, religious, it's what we run from. You know, we want to do it somewhere else. I'm not saying that's the right answer. I'm not trying to imply that. But more people are at that point than we are aware of, it seems to me. What he is saying what we have most in common is creation. It antedates even sin. Let's say the world developed over, as he says in here, billions of years. Sin's only been around for a few thousand years, and so it antedates everything. So you're going back to a root of spirituality. Even antedates the fall and the redemption of Jesus Christ. And that to lift that up may put into perspective all of life, and including the fall and redemption, in a way that would be healthy. He talks about us being on a spiritual journey. And there are paths that we are walking on. And the book is divided very neatly, obviously, heavy-handedly in a sense, because there are these paths and there are so many themes under each path, and the outline is not terrifying, but pretty intense. And if we would look at it in those perspectives, he said, you will have a better understanding of what creation spirituality is about, and that you will... That will be a great advantage to your perception of what it means to be on a spiritual journey. The people that he relies on most heavily, as you will soon see if you haven't already by your reading, is Meister Eckhart, Julian of Norwich, Mechtild of Magdeburg, Hildegard of Bingen, who are all earlier mystics who have thought through what is the meaning behind all of this, some of whom were accused of heresy, and some of whom were convicted of some heresies. You know, the difference between a heresy and an error, by the way, I try to use that distinction. An error is when you're wrong. A heresy is when you stick with your wrongness, and you just, you can't be corrected. You know, that's the way it is. So to be an heretic isn't simply to have made a mistake or to goofed up or even over a period of time, but to say what I'm saying is really right and no one can change me from that, that's what the church usually calls a heretic. Now, they haven't always been that careful about it. They've just, they've gone for all kinds of other reasons, too.
Sometimes they've said you're wrong.
That's right. But these people, they have some of that background. Along with what they may have gone here or there about it, he is saying, and I certainly would join him in saying, they are lifting up something that is terribly important for us to learn. My reaction to the book is that it's poorly written, that it is repetitive, that, as I said, it's hyperbolic, it goes way beyond. Yet I think this book has significant insights. I think there are some fresh connections in the book, and I think it is really deserving of our reflection and examination and absorption, and I think our action. The basic pattern will be twofold, maybe three. One, try to get into what Fox is saying. Two, to examine it by comparing it and discussing it and evaluating it in terms of what else we have heard and seen and experienced. So you will be getting something out of this course, not only if you get Fox, but if you are processing Fox. How does that ring with my experience? Does that really make sense? How does that fit with what I have been taught, or what I know from other people, or what I've seen in my parents or friends or whatever else that may be? So it's that second step that I think is very, very critical. And the third one may be then, and I would hope it would be, all along the line and maybe only more focused at the end, what does this do to me if I buy into some of what Fox is saying? What does this change? As Dan was saying, after you look at the manna, society, you ought to have a session and say, all right, what are the implications for my life, my values, my priorities, my whatever. So we will be trying to do that. Each of the one line I liked in there is each of those four paths is an unfinished meditation. And so its design isn't, well, now here you've got it. as I said, it started you in a way of perceiving and thinking, and it's not done. So you've got to pick it up and move with it. I would be, I'd feel badly if we had went through this and ended up losing a perception of what it means to have evil around, whatever that word evil might mean to you, you put it in its broadest category at the moment, or our effort to run from dealing with it. My own perception is that the question of why there is such a thing as evil, or what Krishna calls or when bad things happen to good people, why there are bad things, is a critical theological question. Always has been, and even more so today. Again, using my illustration from my work at the university where I was, most of the people there were not Christian. No longer. They were all ex. Ex-Lutherans, ex-Catholics, all ex-something else. They had left to go elsewhere. And therefore, if they ever felt that you were out to get them back, there was big barriers. But if you wanted to deal with the questions of life, Governor State University was one of the most religious places I've ever been. They were wide open to that. And how to make, and one of their critical questions was, how come there's stuff that goes wrong? Either in terms of self-deception and deception, or in terms of things that really destroy. How come cancer? Is that your God's joke? Your God permits kids to get run over? Your God permits tornadoes, hurricanes? Your God permits a young mother to die leaving five children? What's all this? I don't know if they're wanting an answer that lays it all out and figures it, but I think they're asking for seriousness, treating their questions seriously. Even if what you end up with is, I don't know, but it's a doggone good question and one that I'm struggling with. That's more than I think they're used to getting. They're called, often, you know, wiped out as unbelievers, you know, or whatever, because you're asking these questions. What Fox is saying in his introduction is that there are at least, what does he list, 10 reasons for having a new paradigm. And he lists all the things that he has there. I think that Freud and Einstein and Marx and Hitler and Werner von Braun are all reasons for having a new paradigm. I think since the advent of personhood understanding that has come symbolically through Freud, that we've tried to understand what it means to be a full being with feelings and with emotions as well as an intellect and certainly a body, that Einstein, who symbolizes the movement of science and technology around us, which has so drastically changed not only the world, but our self-perception within that world, with Marx, the manna person, with economics, were I to study again, to go into the ministry, I think I would be a student of economics and then go to a seminary. That doesn't prove you'd know anything, because I'm not sure anybody understands economics. But a critical question, because it has to do with the distribution of manna. And the Holocaust. Theology cannot be the same. What's that saying? It just went off? You can't understand life the same way anymore. And know about the Holocaust. That is such a dreadful, dreadful experience in human history. May have been repeated other times. We don't know maybe that much about it. But so focused that we cannot just waltz along with the same kind of thought about God. I don't think it's possible.
And then with Werner von Braun, the possibility of, as a symbol for nuclear fission, and what that has meant to this world. He includes that in his 10, of course, too. Most of his, I think, are incorporated in these five people that I've mentioned. That would, for me, make it demanding that we ought to have another way of thinking about it. Yes?
In his intro, I think he talked about, in terms of paradigms, he said mm-hmm. that we have to choose. Mm-hmm. All redemption paradigm, creation-centered paradigm, mm-hmm. that there is, I thought he made it rather very clear that it wasn't an either or, it wasn't a combination or anything. You got to go one way or the other.
And later on in the same book, he doesn't say that. It's different. Yes, I think the introduction is one of the more hyperbolic sections of the book. that he goes, I had the feeling that he got done with the book, and as often as done, you go back and write the introduction then, because you know what you said, and you finally have to figure out why you said it. And then he overstated. He overstates his case in that, because he otherwise in the book he makes it quite clear you couldn't, or unless you include fall redemption within a creation spirituality. But when he sets up the two as antithetical, mm-hmm. and it says you choose both, you can't pretty well make this clear. Make part of it.
I thought he said dualism. I think he puts them on opposite sort of thing.
Right. I know that he does that, and I think he's inconsistent at that point in the book. And of course, in order to stay within the church, he had to. He cannot deny fall redemption theology and remain a member of the Catholic Church. As a priest of the church, he couldn't. And you'll see every once in a while, if you read it again carefully and read it a number of times, you find out there are little places where he stuck in the right kind of stuff in order to say, yeah, I said it, it's there, you know. I think he's inclined strongly to thinking that only through creation-centered spirituality will you really understand anything. And that's, of course, his passion. And that's fine. I'm for that. You may have like passion after a while, after you get into it, it will be similar. But if it rules out the possibility of redemption, fall redemption, you get to a point where you've redone Christianity in a way that is so radical that it may not any longer be related to Jesus Christ as it has been traditionally done. And that's okay. People are going to do that. All I would ask is that they say, yeah, well, it's really something new. It is really a new way of understanding relationship to God. And it is no longer then Christian. But Matthew Fox is Christian. And his book is designed to elucidate the Christian concept of relationship to God. And for those of us who are of that tradition, we end up somehow being focused, as Dan does, on the life, ministry, suffering, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. That little part of this little thing here, that's a critical part of that map, that chart.
And another question, though, with respect to his use of the New Age, mm-hmm. As though it were a sort of a school or a movement in the current day, which I wasn't, I'm not really aware of, that there's, if talking of this New Age, and
I think that academics are much more inclined to do that, than say that, because I think there are classes that are taught differently. They take seriously the Aquarian controversies. What's the book?
Conspiracy
would be a symbol of that kind of thinking. And I think there's great truth. To take those five people that I mentioned and to say if you live as if, or you think and believe as if they had not existed, then you would be old age. And if you live with dealing with the implications of those five, then in that sense you would be the new age. And there would be more than that. You would go to the whole business of what is beyond even what has been given us in terms of emotions and feelings. We don't know how the brain works yet. My illustration, I think I use consistently, is laser. They're working on the possibility of laser communicating not only information to the human brain, but feelings, and attitudes as well. And if some corporation offered you as parents to educate your child in a half hour for $50,000.
But in a certain way.
Right. But they'll offer you choices.
They'll program that they'll take.
Will people buy?
Probably.
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
It'll come out of corporate research. It won't come out of a decision somewhere else, if that happens. So I'm by no means feeling that when I've said Freud, Einstein, Marx, Hitler, and Brown, that I've covered that business. There's so much more. And they're working on it. It isn't as if somebody's thinking that would be a good thing to work on. They're working on it now. MIT, California Institute of Technology.
That brings up my question.
Sure.
Why, if Einstein's science was not good, did not allow such a scientist to come about? And would there, if it hadn't been Einstein, it would have been someone else?
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps in God's world, some good will come of that.
Well, but then you'd have to say the same thing about Hitler.
Then you have, that's what I say. Then you have to say the same thing about the bomb.
Yep, right. See, and that's the struggle.
Yes.
That's the questions that are behind Matthew Fox, it seems to me, are questions like this. Will you be able to do that? Will you be able to bless everything that's ever happened? Or will you not? Creation-centered spirituality gets closer to more acceptance of those things than perhaps what the other model has been. And that's part of, I think, the struggle that we will have when we go through the book.
And June brought up the question when we were talking about the children that she was seeing in her travels who have never heard of Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And how can she tell them that Jesus loves you
mm-hmm.
when they have no conception mm-hmm. of Jesus? And are we going to lose that?
Yeah. Or will... Will a creation-based spirituality allow for a way to get the blessings of Jesus Christ without that precise knowledge? That would be a question that Fox raised.
The reason that I took, you gave us a 10-second variance. I started with nature, then I changed in 10 seconds to Jesus Christ because I think that he includes all of that. I think that's what Matthew Fox is trying to say.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask, how many of you read, have you read much in the book at all?
Introduction.
The introduction, okay. Would you work on the first path, the Via Positiva, which is pages, up to page 130, about 132 or something like that. If you could do that by Tuesday, we'll talk about that Via Positiva tomorrow, so whatever you've read will be an advantage. But if you do that by Tuesday, and then if you could try to have, keep going, and try to have by Thursday, page 175, which is Via Negativa. And then there's another, 75 pages. That would, we'll be into Via Creativa probably on Friday of next week. And then if you would finish the book by the following Tuesday, in other words, if you could have the book completely read by a week from Tuesday, that'd be great. But if you can keep pace with these chapters, that's the ones we'll be focused on. We'll start with Via Positiva tomorrow. Okay? One of the criticisms last time through was it wasn't clear to enough people what the fall redemption thing was about. So if you have questions about that yet, I'd be glad to chat with you about it or to bring it up at the beginning of the class tomorrow. We'll spend a little more clarity on what that is about so that when we start talking creation-centered spirituality, we're a little better off. Okay? Thank you much.
Thank you.